Okay, so I will try and summarize the results that we have obtained so far from the simultaneous monitoring program between Chandra and VLT observations in the near-infrared. And some of those pictures you have already seen. Fred Baganov presented them to you. I will show them again, plus additional graphs, of course, and give some interpretation also in connection to other observational effects that we collected for this in this area. So this is the content of the presentation. I will briefly again show you the results of the 2003 flare, simultaneous flare observations, then go to the new data from 2004. I will then also demonstrate to you one particular measurement that we have in HKNL and X-ray, of course, where we have apparently a quiescent phase. And I will then also describe to you what we see in the mid-infrared and near-infrared towards Sag A star, and we'll then combine all these facts to go into model calculations, simple, very simple synchrotron self-coupled model calculations, and present to you what I think one can say about the spectrum of Sag A star. And in the end, towards the end, I will say something about near-infrared flare statistics, because the near-infrared domain seems to be a very interesting region. Now, 2003. You have seen that before. That was the first simultaneous positive detection of an infrared and X-ray flare that we happened to measure. And the interesting fact here is that we were able to not cover the complete flare, unfortunately, but we sort of got a decaying flank of that first flare. And the cross-correlation that you will see later showed us that the two processes here, that are the process that is at work, and the two flanks that we saw, that they were correlated to within about 10 minutes or so. Telling you something about the physical process, of course. 2004, that is a summary of the 2004 campaign. Again, two long stretches of Chandra observations, and then accompanied by similar long stretches here that we obtained with the VLT. And as you can see, we did mostly H and K observations, and in some cases, we also switched to L bands. That is what you have seen before. Here you see the full K-band coverage together with the X-ray scan. And you see that, in fact, we covered the complete, very significant flare that we have here in the X-ray domain. And we also covered other stretches with possible flare emission here. The only positive detection of a significant flare from the X-ray data by themselves is this flare here, which is about 6 to 8 times stronger than the flare that we detected previously. Other nomenclatures here, phi 2 and phi 4, these are X-ray flux excursions that become sort of significant if you look at them combined with the infrared data. That is the pure infrared plot that you have not seen before. What we show here is a star, S2, I think that is, which is non-variable, and that is the background. You see part of the problem here. There's some apparent correlation between the flux on Sag A star and the background that we see, but you can actually look at individual images, and you can convince yourself that in the different regions where we see definite flare emission, Sag A star, also in the images from which we derived it, is present, and also in that region here, which shows that correlation with the background here, also the Sag A star was in an up phase, in a bright phase, apparently. So that background correlation with the flux here, that's the problem that you have if you work from the ground and not with a stable system as the HST is. That basically is the weather and the AO correction that has to be taken into account here. Now, the first, especially if you look at the H and K band measurements, is that indeed the flare position and the Sag A star radio position agree to within less than 10 milliarc seconds, probably less than of the order of 5 milliarc seconds or so. So the emission is coming from the same region. That we can confirm, of course. And then this picture you have seen already, that shows you the simultaneous emission from the near-infrared and the X-ray domain. You see that, in fact, this weak flare, Phi2, which is not significant from the X-ray data by itself, occurs simultaneously here with the infrared flare that we got in its decaying part when we switched on the system, and we had a complete coverage here. That is a very nice result. And the 2003 data, as I've told you previously, had basically a decaying flank that we could measure. And here we are in the fortunate position of measuring a rising flank. And in fact, my interpretation of this flare, the total flare here, is that we saw a large flare here in the X-ray domain and in the infrared domain that was immediately followed by one of the weaker flares, like this one here, which does not show up strongly in the X-ray domain but has a reasonably strong infrared counterpart. So that's why the decaying flank here in that overall emission spot here does not agree, but I think it does agree if you sort of look upon this as two separate flares that occurred after each other. So this is what I then did here. I looked at the flare at the beginning of the scan that we've seen, Phi2, cross-correlated it with the infrared, and this is the cross-correlation of the bright flare, which is completely dominated by the rising flank. And this is sort of as good as I could do it, cutting out the emission from the flare that followed immediately afterwards, cross-correlated it with the infrared flare. And you see that those cross-correlations result basically in a time delay of less than 10 or 15 minutes between the individual flares. And I should also mention that these cross-correlations were done on the intermediate quiescent state subtracted fluxes. So I subtracted the X-ray backgrounds, the X-ray constant flux, and I also subtracted, as good as it was possible, a constant level as we could measure it from the infrared data before I did the cross-correlation. Now that is then the summarizing result, the 2003 flare and the bright 2004 flare. Here we basically got a very good signal from a rising flank. Here we got a very good signal from a decaying flank. And I think combining this best evidence that we have, I would say we can say that the infrared and X-ray flares that we can see and that are reasonably bright and detectable in both wavelength domains, that they occur simultaneously. Now, quiescent phase, there's another stretch of Chandra data going along with the infrared data, and here we switch between H, K, and L band, actually. And that is also covered, as I saw in a poster and in the short presentation here that Hornstein gave, that there's also Keck, a simultaneous measurement. And in fact, there's evidence for an infrared flare here in the Keck data, and we just didn't get that. So we entirely stayed here in H, K, and L, basically during a quiescent X-ray phase, and these are the corresponding images in H, K, and L with the integration times and the flux limit, the approximate flux limit, and the circle indicates the position of Sagittarius A star. You see, in its quiescent phase, it can be very faint, maybe even absent. That's the summarizing table with fluxes, and what you really should look at is the significant flare here, Phi3 or Roman 3 in the infrared, with about more than 200 nanojanskis in the X-ray domain and about 6 millijanskis in the near-infrared domain, giving that spectral index. Now, I will slightly switch topic. Let's look at the region in the near-infrared. This is a composite map of the HK and L-band images that we obtained. And what you can see here very nicely, this is the position of Sagittarius A star. This here is a blob, an infrared a dust emission blob in the immediate vicinity of Sagittarius A star, at least along the line of sight. So this is what you have to take into account, for instance, if you look at the L-band data, that gives rise to confusing emission. But you also see that blobs like this occur very often in that region. There are several of those, some of them fairly prominent. So the interpretation that I would put forward is that those blobs belong basically to the northern arm or the mini spiral that is coming through here from behind, and that is emission of gas and dust, or dust mostly here, that we see associated with the mini spiral, and which is mostly located behind Sagittarius A star. I would say that if it would be in front of Sagittarius A star, we probably would have seen it because S2 would have passed behind it. so we would have seen a dimming or a reddening effect or so. I think one can, at least in that interpretation, one can safely say that it's behind. One has to look at it, of course, now as a function of time. If it would be close, it should show some variation, proper motions or something. But if you now go to longer wavelength data, and what I've dug out here is Vizier data from the VLT at 8.6 micrometers and 19.5 micrometers. That's the position of Sagittarius star again. You do see that dust blob showing up here as well at longer wavelengths, and there's also extended emission here. And you can actually get fluxes from this. And this is now a summary plot of what one can say about the spectrum, taking into account the infrared emission. These are the fluxes at different wavelengths of the blob. If you actually scale our measurement that we have of the dust blob at 4 microns, you scale that with the mean flux ratio in the spiral between 3.8 and 8.6, you arrive basically at the 8.6 flux level. And also the 8.6 and 19.5 micrometer flux levels agree very well in their ratio with the ratio that you would expect from the mini spiral. So I think that is dust emission and is not associated with Sagittarius star. And that also tells you that most of this stuff here, most of the upper limits, are in fact dust measurements. So what I've invoked here simply is 3 sigma errors as new upper limits for the emission from Sagittarius star. And that fits quite nicely, as you will see. Also, I've illustrated here the measurements that Frank Eisenhower has presented from the flare emissions. So the flare emission here, extrapolated towards longer wavelengths, that would overshoot. That would basically mean that if during these flares we would see strong emission here in the mid-infrared. That has never been reported so far. So I would say that is an indication for, at least in the flare state, for a turnover in the overall spectrum. So what I will now demonstrate to you is very simple synchrotron self-compton calculations that I've carried out here for both the flaring state and for the intermediate quiescent state. I will show them as a graph in a second. I've basically, as in the first paper, assumed a mildly, you don't need that, relativistic blob moving around here. You see the sizes that are required for these calculations to make them work, to make them agree with the X-ray data. They are of the order of a Schwarzschild radius, which is 8 microarc seconds here. And I've actually set up the model such that a turnover in the mid-infrared becomes possible, so the synchrotron spectrum reaches out towards the mid-infrared, and then you are left with a situation that in most of the cases nu 2, so the upper frequency at which synchrotron self-compton radiation is delivered, is just in the infrared or just short of the infrared. Now this is now the situation for a flare. So if you take such a calculation and those two possibilities that would explain this flare that we have seen, and then impose also an exponential cutoff, then you can very nicely, combining the symphony results, explain an overall spectral shape like that. And that would then also be in agreement with the upper limits invoked from the fact that most of the mid-infrared emission towards Sagittarius star is actually dust emission, not associated with Sagittarius star. But of course, you can modify that cutoff and get different spectral indices, so a flatter spectrum would not oppose that kind of a model here. And for the intermediate quiescent states, I've tried out various possibilities here, so you can get all sorts of things, and here in the new plot, you get basically a flat spectrum, so in L nu, that would mean that a minus one spectrum is appropriate for the quiescent state, taking those values here at face values and as measurements. And again, it's in agreement with the new limits. Now, for the overall spectrum, that would mean in this simple model, the following scenario would be valid. You have a synchrotron spectrum with radio fluxes in agreement with fluxes that are measured there, so there's normal amplitudes that you can invoke. spectral indices as you would invoke them from the overall spectrum. With that turnover, that would be in agreement with what Frank Eisenhower showed for flare emissions. And that would then also give you basically the flux densities in the X-ray domain with such a simple synchrotron self-Compton model. It would also mean that for modeling, you would not have to worry about this part here. That is mostly dust, not associated with Sagittarius star. And it would also mean, quite comparable to what Farhad has said, that I would say that it looks like as if the radio spectrum, at least in the flaring state of Sagittarius star, is peaked at about 1 terahertz, say a couple of 100 gigahertz, so basically near 1 millimeter. And also, I should point out, the magnetic fields that are required are small, only a few gauss basically in quiescent phase, and a few 10 gauss here, 50 gauss or so. That's still reasonable and in agreement with more sophisticated model calculations here. That is fine. Now that tells you that the infrared domain is a very special domain. Variability that you can observe there basically tells you something about the distribution of radiating electrons. So it depends on where the cutoff exactly is. The cutoff can move. It depends on whether or not you get only synchrotron emission, or you may also get synchrotron self-Compton emission, depending on what the spectrum actually is that comes about with a flare. And that tells you that the near infrared is ideal for looking at flares, as we have seen. And what I've just tried here is set up a toy model of what you can say concerning the flare rate. So what is the basically the spectrum of flare amplitudes that we observe within that model, and taking into account what we have seen so far. So the new measurements are in full agreement with about 4 ± 2 flares per day in the infrared. So if you take that value, you land about here in that graph. That is that cross. Then I also invoke here as an assumption that there is a characteristic flare length of about 100 minutes, plus or minus something. So most of the flares that we have seen are okay with that assumption, I think. We have not seen flares that are a day long, or we have not seen flares that last only for a few minutes or so. They are about 100 minutes, approximately. And then you assume also that the quiescent emission, the quiescent emission in the infrared domain, is basically also low flare activity with that characteristic time. So that means that all the time that you don't see detectable bright flares, you can now divide by 100 and get a flare rate for the weak flares. That gives you 2 points and a slope. And in fact, if you scale the Hornstein results and the Feynman results, if you scale those to the 100 minutes, then they are right on that power law. And I should also say that power law index of about -1.4 is not dependent on the flux value here, because that just shifts those limits along that line. So that then tells you what the likelihood is of seeing bright flares. If not, there would be cutoffs, of course. I mean, the physical process could put hard limits on the presence of bright flares. So these are those Kappa 1s and Kappa 2s. And a simulation would look like that, very much like what you observe. Each box is a flare, so you go through deep minima sometimes. And that's a summary. Talk short enough that you should know this by heart. I should also mention, I would like to point out the stuff that we presented here from the Cologne group. And I should also mention that there is interferometry measurements now on S3. So we have done MIDI interferometry on S3. And please look at the latest ESO messenger. And I should also mention that next year we are in the hard planning phases already to have another conference like this. And there's lots of progress. And I think even next year, and a year from now, there will be very interesting new results that will be reported. And we plan to have this here in Batonev, which is just south of Cologne, and it's in Germany, of course. So it's in 18th to 22nd of April. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Ramesh?
Yes.
Is there any difference between these two?
in a spectral, well, you can calculate the spectral index, of course. I mean, and that is of course is different. It was given in the table. I think it's minus 1 point. It's flatter for the strong flares, so it's minus 1.1, I think, and it's about minus 1.3 for the weaker flares. So, but that's just describing what you said. I mean, I think it just depends on the distribution of electrons that are delivered in that process, with that, and that gives just those two brands of flares. And they're probably not different brands. It's just probably a continuum of phenomena that you see.
Okay.
I'm not convinced that
we need to. Yeah, you're right. That's what I said, basically. Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it was very clear in the first paper last year that the intermediate quiescent phase basically only described the phase in which some infrared activity was seen, which was not as bright as the brightest flares that you see there. But I have, for instance, made use of that assumption that there is no quiescent phase when I said that all the intermediate quiescent flare activity can be seen as low-level activity of Sag A star. So,
yes. You don't have a quiescent level. Just
I mean, as I said, I mean, it probably solely depends on the kind of electron spectrum that you put into the process.
It's hard to take.
Okay. So yeah, no, the simultaneous spectra. Now that was what Frank showed. Was that was the first simultaneous infrared spectra that we have, and those happen to be very steep, indicating that there is a synchrotron cutoff apparently. But we also heard that simultaneous measurements, very 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 close to simultaneous measurements, are possible with the Keck telescope, and that gives a flatter spectrum. So that is basically the answer, and it's rephrasing what I said before. It just depends on the electron spectrum, and I mean what is delivered. So you can have flat and steep spectra apparently for the bursts.
Felix.
No, it's the electron gamma that really is important. I mean, you don't need boosting. It's you can make it with 10 to the 3 gamma e.
Yes. You want to go back to that slide?
Yes. Well.
Yeah. You can get an idea just by looking at the data points.
Sorry for that. No. No.
Ten. Yeah. Or 12.
This one you mean? You mean that? Well, I would believe this flare, right? I would also say that there is flaring activity here. If you look at the images, you can clearly see an on state, and that, of course, I would believe. All the fine structure, I think, is questionable. The background is a flux measurement in the vicinity. Not too far away, but also not too close. So depending on the strail, you may see the strail of the atmosphere in the background.
That's outside the influence of the PSF of Sagittarius yes. Star. Okay.
Well, I just said it depends on the strail, on the correction. It's you do see the wings of the PSFs. So the atmosphere turns good, or the correction of the atmosphere is better or worse. Something like that, yes. I think it's a marvelous idea. Well, we have one more flare where we do see a short-term variability, which looks like a quasi-variability of that time scale, but the signal is low. I didn't show it. So there's one more moderately good case that shows the same. So I think we have to get more statistics. There's two of those scans that show that phenomenon, and we just have to keep looking.
Yes, Sergey.
It's very difficult. I mean, you have to assume what it is, right? You can do very crude estimates, and I did a very crude estimate, of course. You can go to the literature and see what mass the molecular what mass the northern arm has from molecular line measurements, and you can just get a coverage. I mean, what part of the sky does the blob have compared to the northern arm, and just crudely derive a mass from that. And I got something like 10^-2 solar masses. But it depends, of course, on the density and whatnot, if you do it correctly. This is a very crude measurement. But it gives you approximately the range, I guess.
Yes, Julie?
I didn't understand the question. Yes? Well,
In other words,
that's what we've done basically.
Is this
right?
A star or is this in between the stars in the background?
Oops. There's this. Okay. That's how a star looks like. You can take any of those. That's the noise level. That's a flat signal. Yeah.
The star is not actually there.
And the star is much brighter, of course, than. Yes.
Andreas, is there any dithering here, or are you just staring? Because that can make it look like variability.
Oh no, it's just staring. It's just staring. It's near infrared. It's not a problem here.
Well, you might have a bad pixel. That's the only reason to dither.
yeah, sure. Yes. It is done okay. Properly. I mean, bad pixel is taken care of.
Okay.
Yes. Well, you just. This is the best effort that we present here.
Okay, one more, Charlie.
Well, I mean, as I said, it is definitely a function of the AO correction, right? And that reflects itself in all sorts of quantities, right? In the peak flux, in the leakage. Well, Well, I mean, we have to look into this. I mean, it is linked to the AO correction, of course. And there's more than one star, right? It's just, it adds up.
Yeah, you might want to average over the whole array, normalize it as your background rather than just look at one star.
Yes, but I mean, this is a very crowded area, right? There's just no free, and this is after deconvolution, and there's no free region, right? It's difficult. It's not ratioed, is it? It's a direct measurement. Yes. Well, because we wanted to present the true data to you. So this is what it looks like. Well, yes, but...
Okay. Yeah, there may be gain as well as DC level variations, but I think we'll have to stop the discussion now and go on to our next speaker. Let's thank Andreas one more time.